Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Martinson, and today we are talking with the host of The Hidden Secrets of Money, noted speaker, best-selling author on monetary history and gold and silver investing, the CEO of goldsilver.com. We are talking with Mike Maloney, somebody who I consider to be both a fellow educator and a friend in this business. Welcome, Mike.
It's great to be here, Chris.
You know, I don't have many regrets, but one of them is that after we took that absolutely brilliant ride in your Tesla Model S, which completely opened my eyes to what a 21st century automobile would be like, my regret is that I didn't buy Tesla stock that afternoon.
Yeah, you know, I don't own any Tesla stock. My only investment is gold and silver. And I don't regret, I could have bought it at the IPO because I owned a Tesla, and Tesla owners, the people that bought Roadsters and supported Tesla, were sort of offered first shot at this during the IPO. And so I think it was like, I don't know what it was, $18 or something like that back then. And but, you know, I didn't. I've just stuck to my guns, and I accumulate gold and silver. And so far, that's it. But I'll tell you, I have been so tempted lately to open up a trading account again and buy some long-term, some leaps, but some puts on the S&P or the Dow, because I think that we are nearing a tipping point here very shortly.
Well, let's talk about that. You know, you've studied money, monetary history, and I think both you and I, if we're honest, we'd say we were surprised by the absolute willingness of the population to buy back into a third bubble, and B, the power of printing to actually get people to suspend all disbelief, to the point that we have somebody like Janet Yellen, people hanging on her words when she says, oh, I'm complacent about complacency. I don't see anything here to worry about. And from my perspective, if you're not worried about this historic level of complacency at this juncture with all the geopolitical things going on, you're absolutely nuts. And
I believe so. But what it does is it offers an opportunity for the people that are awake. this is the time. I mean, right now, the volatility index is very, very low.
Yep.
Margin debt is at extreme highs again. They're both in the range where a crisis happens. And gold prices have been beaten to death. So gold and silver, for me, I mean, I just, I've got a monthly accumulation plan. Every once in a while, I buy more than that. And last week, I placed a purchase. Once that $50 up day for gold, where the moving averages were blown through and resistance was blown through, I figured I didn't care if it fell right afterwards. It changed the conditions. And the gold-silver ratio, silver was outperforming gold, and that suggests that this is probably, that the bear market in precious metals has probably ended, and we have seen the bottoms.
Well, there's certainly some confirmation of that in, say, the leveraged junior miner ETFs and other sort of very volatile and sensitive indicators like that, saying that the stock prices, particularly the most sensitive ones, have certainly rallied quite a bit in the last just few weeks here. So that's always possible. Now, you know, as I look at the daily trading markets, that $50 up day, that did pop in the U.S. markets. But I think today is a more typical example where gold was up in the overnight markets pretty good. 8 o'clock rolls around and mysterious selling of gold comes along, and it's really contained and compressed. Is this just normal market behavior? You think this is just a lot of people with a lot of money saying, all things equal, I'd rather be in high beta stocks than gold?
Absolutely not. Gold and silver are a manipulated market. The evidence is absolutely overwhelming. But thank God for the manipulation, because without it, we never would have seen $250 gold.
Right.
And gold right now would probably be $3,000 an ounce, and there would be no opportunity. The opportunity comes because of the manipulation.
Hmm. Well,
so I know that that's counter to all the other people that you've talked about that want to try and end the manipulation. But the longer it goes on, the more people are offered the opportunity to get in at just unrealistic, unreasonable. These prices are just stupid low. And so people can get in at these prices, and the longer they suppress it, the more pressure is built up and the higher it will ultimately go, is my feeling.
We've been building several years of pressure then, and it should be interesting when she lets go. Now, I'm really interested in your how your hidden secrets of money has been received and what sort of feedback you're getting from that and what sort of opportunities are opening up. Because it is, hands down, the highest quality and most complete tour through money that exists in the world today. And so what do you have? Do you have 5 of those episodes out now?
There's 5 official episodes of Hidden Secrets of Money, and then we release videos. We release at least a video a week.
Mm-hmm.
But a few of the, I recently did an update to the my presentation that's entitled Death of the Dollar. And that update was extremely well received. The numbers of likes versus dislikes,
mm-hmm.
I haven't seen a ratio that high before.
Nice.
So it's the whole thing is rewarding. I actually would, this is what I like doing, and what I want to do is to create really high quality information and educate people. My precious metals business just funds that activity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Hidden Secrets of Money is shot in 18 countries, and we have 2 full-time animators. And so it is produced like a production that would be for public broadcasting or something like that. It's
well. So tell me about the reception from it. Are you getting certainly? You know what we're experiencing at Peak Prosperity is that as the markets keep getting jammed higher and whatnot, we don't feel like we have the full attention of people and that a more robust attention will be coming when things inevitably, this volatility and lack thereof bites us again, as it will. We feel like we'll get more attention at that point. Are you getting a solid response from this that's good, feels right to you?
It all depends on the episode. I know that, you know, we have been in this pullback in gold and silver, so when it comes to stuff that's about gold and silver,
mm-hmm.
It hasn't been popular lately. The public tends to chase whatever's hot.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times what is hot happens to be yesterday's news. I'm a very counter-cyclical person. I go the opposite direction of the crowd most of the time. And during this whole pullback, I have had, there's been no question in my mind that this bull market in precious metals was not over with. In fact, it really has not gotten going yet. But when it comes to the interest in Hidden Secrets of Money, our 4th episode, which is how the world monetary system works, how we borrow currency into existence, and it basically enslaves us by, it's borrowed on the back of a treasury bond, and the treasury bond has to be paid for through future taxation. But most of the currency supply is borrowed into existence when you buy a house or a car or charge something on a credit card. And when you borrow that currency into existence, you have to pay it back, but you also owe interest on it. And so you have whatever prosperity we enjoy as a society today, even if you only use cash, we have to pay for it in the future through future taxation or mortgage payments or car payments. So, you know, as a society, it's a pretty weird situation, but we owe all of our prosperity back,
mm-hmm.
plus interest. It's an insane situation is what it is.
Yeah, you know, I've had some, it's been said that there's this economist out of Australia, Steve Keen, and he talks about how our it's possible that our money system is not necessarily exponentially expansionary, but I don't really have much to talk about in that regard, because when we look at real world data, what we see are perfectly exponential growth charts for both debt and its associated product currency. And so those two things have been growing nearly perfectly exponentially. Everything that the governments and their central bank handmaidens are attempting to do is to get us back on that path. They've been printing like crazy. And Mike, here we are, what, six and a half years into this whole recovery idea of printing like crazy. And when I look at the economic numbers, only at the very headline can you say, oh, GDP is, you know, sort of advancing. But when you get under the covers and you talk to real people, you discover it's getting hard out there. Inflation for ordinary people is much higher than the official statistics would suggest, 1% higher, 2% higher, 5%, pick a number, but it's much higher. And we can detect that in the stresses of people. There's lots of signs of stress out there. But you don't see it everywhere. So you're in Southern California.
I'm in Southern California near the coast. I live very close to the ocean. And my business is located in Santa Monica. And when you talk about inflation, they don't include housing. Mm-hmm. And because real estate has been pushed up into this enormous bubble again, mm-hmm. Through quantitative easing, or why don't we just call it what it is, currency printing. Because it's been pushed up so high, rents are insane. It is very difficult around here. I mean, I've got a number of employees, and it's getting difficult for the employees to make a living these days because rents, it's hard to find a place to live that's less than $3,000 a month.
Ouch.
Yeah.
And that's just an ordinary place, I assume. We're not talking a castle?
No, I'm just talking about like a one or a two bedroom place in Santa Monica. That's the cost of a little one bedroom apartment.
Wow.
So I'm talking about the places that my employees would be looking for. Mm-hmm. You go inland a little where it's a little bit hotter and a little smoggier, and it starts getting a little cheaper. But it's because the average home here, like a three-bedroom home, most of those are, they're above a half million. And for every $1 million of home value, their mortgage payment would be about $5,000 a month. And there's a level of insanity to it also. I live in the Santa Monica Mountains, and there are places for rent there during the summer months that are $100,000 a month.
Yikes. I'd rather have...
By the way, that fourth episode that describes why it always has to grow exponentially, the fourth episode of Hidden Secrets of Money, just went 2 million views a couple of weeks.
Oh, congratulations.
The reception on those types of things has been very, very good.
That's really robust.
Yeah, thanks. And how is the Accelerated Crash Course doing?
Well, it's just out of the gate. We have almost a weekend and a day's worth of information under our belts. And we're a little over 40,000 views on the weekend, so we feel good about that. And we'll see how it does. So what we like is that a lot of people, particularly in our faithful, have said, thank you, we've been waiting for something a little shorter and a little updated and a little glitzier. So we hope that will help people wake up. And what's interesting, Mike, is that I've been on Fox News recently and Glenn Beck show and some other sort of media appearances where people in the media are starting to wake up to the idea that there's something kind of off in the whole resource story, particularly around the Iraq story, because I've just been continually on this idea that there's not as much oil as we thought, and the stuff that is left is just more expensive than the old stuff. And everybody looks at the dollars, but it's not the dollars that matters. What matters is the extra energy that we get from those activities, because we run all of Santa Monica and Montague, where I live, we run that on surplus energy. I don't care if North Dakota's busy, churning, fracking, creating a lot of energy, but it's using almost all of that to create more energy. And so North Dakota is booming like crazy, but they don't have any extra to send. That's what we're really talking about in this story, is that the cheap oil is gone. And it, what is left of it is hard to come by. And guess what? The last best hope, the last best cheap oil reservoirs in the world were where? Where? Oh, Iraq, right? Where a number of, let's call them policy blunders, if we want to be kind, are coming home to roost on that front in terms of world oil supplies. So there's a really, really big story there. And the good news is, such as it is that I think, you know, the Iraq crisis is giving the media a little bit of an opportunity to wake up and say, hey, I thought this whole oil thing was behind us. Why is it still in front of us? And so we have some opportunities to get that out. But, you know, here's the my main summary. If you can't grow oil exponentially, why are you trying to grow your money and credit or your currency and your credit exponentially? You know, that's just a right. really bad mismatch. And it seems like nobody at the Fed has the first inkling that something like reality actually exists.
Right. And in order for the currency supply has to grow at a certain rate. And that means the economy has to grow to match it or something's out of whack. And the problem is you can't grow the economy without energy, right?
That's it.
That's it.
It's okay. Really that simple. And, you know, what's interesting, more and more people are catching on to the idea that this isn't quite right. And this is where I think that the golden age of educating is just about to kick off. And one of the things I love is that a lot of things seem to be slipping out of the hands of what I'll call the system, the status quo. And one of them is information. Really, you know, the number of people, like when you look at CNBC's viewership, I would be just aghast if those were my numbers. You know, it's just a steady erosion. You look at CNN, just a steady erosion, because frankly, they're putting out a really bad product that doesn't offer appropriate context. It's just a sales job for whatever narrative they want to sell. And guess what? People aren't tuning into that. And instead of saying, wow, our product stinks, maybe we should do this differently, they just keep doing it, grinding those businesses into the dirt. And meanwhile, you know, the internet is over here quietly taking all that mind share and eyeballs gladly from them. And that's the interesting part to me, Mike, is that the system doesn't seem to be self-aware enough to know how to change its behavior or something. I don't quite understand it yet.
Yeah, you know, changing the behavior would require shifts in power and taking away power from some entities. And these entities have a vested interest in staying right where they're at. You know, the way the government works and the way central banking works and the way the big banks work, they don't want that to change. And all of that would have to change in order for the economy and the currency supply to be in alignment with one another and to be in alignment with energy supplies. And so this is a big threat to them. And I think what's happening is that they're just pushing this thing, and they'll keep on pushing it out to the limit until one day the whole thing sort of implodes.
Well, let's talk about that implosion, because I don't know anybody better to talk to about this. And that's the idea that the implosion will be talked about and experienced by many people as a wealth destruction, but you've always described it as a wealth transfer. Why is that?
Well, the true wealth isn't destroyed. It's just transferred. People think that the currency is the wealth, and the currency just stores economic energy temporarily. I mean, you create something, you work for something, and you trade that for currency, and basically the energy that you put into the thing that you created, or the product or service, is now in that currency. It's economic energy. And the currency is just used to divide it up, store it over a period of time, and you can deploy the purchasing power when and where you need it in the amount that you need. And so that's all currency is for. And people mistake that for wealth. The wealth is all of the stuff in society that currency is used to buy. The wealth is apartment buildings and cars and oil wells and power plants and factories and office buildings and especially the things that can generate an income for somebody, things that cash flow. So that's the true wealth. And in an economic collapse, that stuff does not get destroyed. It just changes hands.
Hmm.
The people that are out on debt especially end up like during the Great Depression, there was a huge wealth transfer. People lost, anybody that was way out on debt lost their farms. They lost everything. I am expecting a short-term deflation that the Fed can't control. People think that the Fed can really control things, and all they can do is influence the economy with what they do. They can increase the quantity of base money, which is the paper currency that exists, basically, and the reserves that the banks hold on deposit at the Federal Reserve. And then when the bank's balance sheets are too cash heavy, they want to go out and loan that currency. They can also take cash off of the bank's balance sheets and put more bonds on the balance sheets, and that causes the banks to raise interest rates, and that thereby slowing down lending and cooling the economy off. But the Fed does not have a direct link to the economy where they can instantly control it. And most of the currency supply comes from us borrowing currency into existence when we buy a car or a house or sign a credit card. And if the public gets scared and they start paying down more debt, when you pay down debt, the currency you use to pay that debt down is extinguished. When it goes back and meets when the currency meets the debt on the books at the banks, they cancel each other. And so if the public gets scared and stops borrowing more into existence each month than they pay off by paying down debt, then the whole currency supply starts to collapse. It starts to go into a deflationary collapse. And I think, and this is what I wrote back in my book, book was released in 2008, but I was writing this in 2006 and 7, is that there would be this short-term deflation, and all central banks are scared to death of deflation. They do not want deflation. And so the reaction by the world's central banks would be to print until deflation gives way, potentially causing hyperinflations.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the deflation I'm talking about is a contraction of the currency supply. Not all prices will be falling.
Right.
The stuff that people need to survive will probably continue getting more expensive. But, you know, you live in a situation where if things go bad, you will be okay. I have a bunch of emergency food, and I've got a Berkey water filter, and I live on a property that has a year-round stream that runs through it.
Uh-huh.
So I've got water and food, and I feel okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Well, it's interesting that the central banks do fear deflation. The press goes out of its way to just dutifully report that, you know, things like inflation is dangerously low and to really talk about deflation as if it's a bad thing. But then they conflate it with the idea that that's the same thing as prices falling. And so that's how we know that there's dangerously low inflation, because prices are low. But the truth of the matter is, you and I and everybody else in the world loves low prices. Why wouldn't we love low prices? We want prices to be falling. In fact, they should be falling given technology gains, process efficiency
right.
improvements, increased manufacturing capacity. All of those things are good reasons for prices to fall. And yet the Fed and the other central banks, they pretend they're looking at those prices. I don't think they're that dumb. They know better. They don't care about prices. Honestly, Mike, I don't think they care if your tomato sauce costs $100 million next year or a penny. They don't really care. But they do care if credit and currency are growing in the banking system, because I think that's the whole game. Like, it's literally that simple. Like, either those things grow or they don't, and if they don't, it's bad.
Well, in a deflation, debtors are punished and savers are rewarded, and since the government is the largest debtor, that's something that they don't want. They don't want the government punished for its irresponsibility. It becomes much harder. If in a deflation, tax revenues will go down, but the amount that the government owes on all those bonds that it issued isn't going to go down. That's
right.
a fixed number, and they're going to have a lot harder time paying it without basically repudiating its debt and basically declaring bankruptcy.
So I know this has been going on for a long time. We're in our fifth year of jamming. The stock market's been on a ruler straight up slope since about 3 years now. And
yeah, doesn't that ruler straight thing, which by the way, it's sort of like a wedge pattern that's coming to a peak right now, but the look of that thing is very suspicious.
You think?
go ahead and finish your thought.
Well, that is kind of my thought, but what I see is that the Fed's really in a box, because you mentioned one of their mechanisms for getting out of this box is to take the things on their balance sheet, which are these assets, which are frankly just treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. So we'll just call them securities. They could take these debt securities and they could move them off their balance sheet, push them back out into the market, and force people or banks to take them, and thereby remove some of the currency from the system. And theoretically, that causes rates to rise and banks would lend less. And that's their typical lever to control things once things begin to overheat. I don't think they can do that anymore. I don't think that they
have
the
capability.
No, they
can't. They've trapped themselves.
So if they can't do that, I was talking with Axel Merck recently, and he thought that he agreed with that. And he's got William Poole, former CEO of the St. Louis Fed and FOMC member, former. But he's looking at this whole thing, kind of a hawkish guy anyway, but he's saying there's absolutely no way they can do that. And their only option at this point would be to start raising interest rates on those excess reserves that are held at the central bank. And that's really their only tool. But even that's a tricky thing, because optically, once they start giving banks more of an incentive to keep the money with them rather than lend it out by raising interest rates, they're just handing tens and hundreds of billion to the banks for money that they just printed out of thin air. So
yes, and think about how immoral this is, because first of all, the Fed whipped up that currency, yeah, not out of thin air, but by indebting the public. They buy a treasury bond or a mortgage-backed security, and now they own the mortgage on your house.
That's
or
true.
They own this treasury bond that you are going to work for in the future and pay taxes to pay off that treasury bond. And so they give all this currency to the banks, and then they pay them interest to not loan it out and stimulate the economy. And so they're giving them this gift of interest, and the Fed is supposed to turn over any profits that it has at the end of the year is supposed to get turned over to the Treasury. Well, if they're paying them interest, that reduces the amount that they give to the Treasury by exactly that amount. So in other words, the public is paying those banks interest. That's where all the interest comes from.
Absolutely.
Because we're not going to see those profits passed on to the Treasury anymore.
This is deeply unfair. It's unjust, and it angers me, because one of the things that happened in...
It's evil.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that happened recently legislatively, Congress in its infinite financial wisdom decided to allow a relaxation of the rules around the certain things that banks can get involved in, and the language pretty much specifically reads, as long as it's directly related to the banking industry, that they can invest in it. So banks are now some of the biggest owners and players in things like the full cycle chain of commodities, right? They own the warehouses, they own the mining production, they own the sales end of the whole thing. And how did the banks come to be the owners of those really monstrously valuable tangible assets? They took advantage of free money that was handed to them, that was printed out of thin air. That's a very different dynamic than how you might become an owner of a mine and a warehouse and a distribution mechanism for a solid substance like copper or something.
You and I would have to work.
Yeah, we'd have to work. It's extraordinary. So if the Fed's got themselves in a box, though, they're in this box, and I don't think they know how to get out of it. I truly think that they're just making ad hoc decisions. I think they look at whatever was on the tape yesterday, and they make a decision about whether they're going to taper or not or something. I don't have a sense they have a real master game plan. What's your take?
I don't believe they do either. This was all an experiment, and all of these quantitative easings and currency creation, and the quantitative easing, they've tapered, but they are still doing it. And, they might taper down to zero, but the point is, this is an extreme emergency maneuver to create all of this currency. And they did it on a scale that has never before been done. And the fact that here we are 5 years down the road from the crisis, and they're still doing it. So what is, if the emergency is supposed to be over with, why are they doing these emergency maneuvers? There's something still sick behind the curtain that the public can't see. But, when I was writing my book, I'm a believer in cycles. And I started loading every crises and stock market crash and so on that the U.S. has experienced into a spreadsheet, looking for some sort of regularity, you know, some sort of repeating cycle. And something really stuck out at me, and that was that there was a shift in monetary system every 30 to 40 years. And at that time, when I did that back in 2005 or 6, nobody had written about it yet. Now, people are writing about this shift in monetary system. And I just did an update to a presentation that I've been giving for 4 years called The Death of the Dollar Standard. The, you know, we had the classical gold standard before World War I, a gold exchange standard between the wars, the Bretton Woods system from 1944 to 71, and then the accidental default when Nixon took us off of gold in August of 71 was the U.S. dollar standard. There were some emergency meetings just like there had been in 1922 in the Genoa Conference and the Bretton Woods meetings in 1944. There was emergency meetings called the Washington Accord in 71, but nothing really came of it. As soon as the tie was severed between gold and the U.S. dollar, the foreign currency exchange markets sprang up, and the default was the dollar standard, because countries, because of the a fortunate chain of events for the U.S. dollar, had caused the rest of the world to have to hold dollars because of the two world wars. And this is the most, this system wasn't designed. If it was designed, it's a very, very poor design, the worst of all of them. And it's the longest lived. And it is building up pressures inside of it right now to where it seems like every week there is another nail in the coffin of the dollar standard. And all of these countries making bilateral trade agreements, and Russia and China with all these deals they just put together that are not going to require the U.S. dollar any longer. The world is turning its back on U.S. dollars. And all of this is converging with all of these crazy experiments the Federal Reserve has done. And, you know, I absolutely believe that there are economic consequences to this that are inescapable. There is a, you know, they're not just in a box, but a trap has been set. And I don't, you're not going to see, before the end of this decade, if there is still a U.S. dollar around, it will not be this U.S. dollar. It will be a dollar that is tied to a very different monetary system. And the last three shifts in monetary system were little baby steps off of the classical gold standard, where it was fully backed. We went down to 40% reserve ratio with the Federal Reserve in the United States and during the gold exchange standard. And then the Bretton Woods system didn't have a reserve ratio specified. I believe that there was about the dollar was about 8% backed by the time Nixon took us off of gold in 71. Now, the only backing that the U.S. dollar has is the promise to tax us all in the future. It's U.S. Treasury bonds. Or, you know, the Fed during its quantitative easing was also buying mortgage-backed securities. And how corrupt is the notion that you can give some entity the power to have a checkbook that has a zero balance and they can go out and buy anything they want with that, and it just creates currency. That's corrupt in itself. But anyway, I do think that this system is coming to an end before the decade is out, and that this one will affect the lives of every, this shift in monetary system. The other ones were these baby steps off of gold. Now we've got to go from nothing, most likely back to something. And it's going to be a financial, economic convulsion, the likes of which the world has never seen. It's going to affect everybody on the planet. The last three monetary shifts, it was only the world's central banks and big international banks that were affected and were worried. The common man didn't even know what was going on. This one, everybody is going to feel it. Everybody's going to know it. You will either be a winner or a loser. But everybody is playing this game.
Well, it's interesting then to note that it was just a few days ago I read that Putin's advisor proposed an anti-dollar alliance to halt U.S. aggression, right? You know, thinking of that as a way to begin to hamstring the U.S. But I don't think many people in the State Department really appreciate the extraordinary degree of benevolence that's been granted to them by this fact that we get to export trillions of dollars and they never come home. And that's just an extraordinary gift to be able to do that. But if the U.S. really had to start paying its own way, with its trade deficit every month, being what, 30, 40, 50 billion, depending on the month,
right?
Then that would have
to our economy would be vastly different.
Vastly different. The rules like poor Greece. They're over there like, gosh, we either have money or we don't. They're like the ordinary person of nation states. They have to live with the reality of money. But when you can print your own, there's less reality. That's distorting all on its own. And so nowadays, when I'm asked, is the U.S. going to lose its reserve currency status? The answer is it's already happening, but it's happening by increments right now, right? We're seeing people shift
but
and
things
diversify.
Are accelerating, and there's going to come a day. It seems like some things happen very slowly until the day that it doesn't happen slowly
anymore.
And it happens very, very fast. And I think that this is going to be something like that, where it's going to unfold slowly like it is, but you can really see it speeding up. I released a video on this about the beginning of this month. I was speaking up in Canada, and my presentation was on the nails in the dollar's coffin. And we released that video. It's been very popular, but the reason I had to do that video is because they're just speeding up so much, all of these different countries trying to bypass the U.S. dollar, and all those excess dollars that are overseas are going to come home. And the way they come home, you remember back in the late 80s when Japan was having the Nikkei stock market boom. The Japanese came over to the United States and they bought up Rockefeller Center and most of downtown Los Angeles,
Pebble Beach,
Chicago. Every place that was Class A property experienced this enormous inflation, where the cost of properties doubled in just a few years. The same thing will be happening when all of these dollars that have dollars overseas do not need them anymore. What do they do with them? Well, they come over here and they buy something. And so those dollars come home. And once they're in circulation, of course, we will start seeing much more massive inflation. So we're on a very weird, wild roller coaster of a ride right now. And the Fed has made things infinitely worse with their interventions and distortions. And I expect, I read a book back in 1998, that was published in 98, called The Great Economic Disorder by Larry Bates. And in it, he said that wealth is never destroyed, it is merely transferred. And when I read that, I went, wow, that means that this is going to be the greatest wealth transfer in the history of mankind. And then Robert Kiyosaki started saying it when he was on the news media, and now you hear it sometimes on the news media. But the thing is, it will be. This is going to be an amazing event, and all you can do is do your best. It's a pretty scary thing coming at us down the track. There is a possibility that there's light on the other side of this dark tunnel, but and that, you position yourself right, maybe it's going to be the best thing that ever happened to you. I don't know. It also might be just a catastrophe for the entire world, especially the West. Any country that has a very large and well-developed credit system is going to experience great pain, I believe.
There's a really interesting set of studies out there in psychology where they'll put two male rats in a cage and they're fine. And then they start administering painful shocks, electric shocks to their feet in a way that they can't avoid them, right? They can't get up on a food container or something. So they can't, all of a sudden they're being shocked and these two formerly friendly male rats will just start fighting. And if you keep the shocks up, they'll really injure or even kill each other. And the reason for that is that they lack the ability to understand what's administering the pain. So they look around for something that makes sense and they go, it's you. It's you, Mr. Other Rat, right? And so they fight. And really what I'm looking around the world, I look at what's going on like in the Ukraine or in Iraq or something like that. Really, these are people who've been administered some pretty hefty economic shocks over time, and they don't have a lot of opportunities left, and they don't really understand who's been administering the shocks and why they've been coming. And so they look at each other and they fight. And not to say, people are rats and we're better than them or anything. It's just that this is a normal behavior in animals. And I truly believe that if people don't have the education to understand why what's happening is happening, that this was all put in motion a very long time ago. This was a series of regrettable and unfortunate decisions, but they're understandable. And we can figure out why they happened. If we don't have that context, the context that you're providing and that I'm trying to provide, I worry that what we're going to do is, as a nation, decide that it was some other rat's fault, right? And we'll have to fight them. And we'll convince our people that it was China that ruined us, or Russia, or somebody. It won't matter. And we'll go down that route again. And it's just very unfortunate, because this is all completely not mysterious. It's completely understandable what's happening. And this is by design, if you will. I mean, the people consciously chose to put
in
place a system.
It also keeps the average person from blaming the true cause.
Because
the true cause is our own government, and it's our own central bank that is causing this problem. And, you know, there's a lot of cycle believers believe in the war cycle. And, you know, we've experienced this relative calm, and now it's sort of time for a storm when it comes to the war cycle. And but, you know, if everybody's lives economically suddenly take an enormous downturn, and the politician responsible can say, oh, it's China's fault, then, the politician gets a pass, basically. They don't have to take the consequences. And that's the public. It's a shame that the general public doesn't, that your listeners are people that are digging deeper. And it's really up to your listeners to try and inform neighbors and get people more involved in what's happening to them, the economy, watching things like the Accelerated Crash Course, watching things like my fourth episode on Hidden Secrets of Money. When people understand how the world works and what is happening around them, they're a lot more likely to attribute consequences to the proper cause.
Indeed. And so I applaud you for the work you're doing there. And in the interest of helping people get on the right side of the line, if it's possible, for the coming wealth transfer, I've always thought that, you know, it's real assets. You have to own real assets. And gold and silver, I think, are the most accessible for the most people. That's probably the easiest thing you can do. Slightly harder is to understand what a true asset really is, the cash flows. And by cash flows, I don't mean currency, but it has value that will have some form of flow to it at some point in the future, whatever we're using, whether that's bitcoins or gold or carrots, it doesn't really matter. But understanding what real assets are and owning those, is that sort of the context for why you have a monthly gold and silver purchase plan?
Looking back through history, during a currency crisis, the absolute number one asset by a long shot is the precious metals, gold and silver. Those are the things that perform better than anything else. And if they're giving you performance that is double, triple, quadruple, whatever the second best performer is, mm-hmm. Well, that means if you're invested in the best performer, you could buy double, triple, or quadruple of as much of the second best performer. And then the things that are going down, I mean, in the 1970s, if you had sold a home in 1971, when gold became free trading, and if you bought silver, by 1980, just 8.5 years later, you could buy you could buy 19 homes that were identical to it, I believe, 18 or 19 of the in just that short period of time. real estate went up during that time. So anybody invested in real estate believed that they were making gains. But against gold, they lost a tremendous amount of value, over 90%. You know, if it was 20 homes, that would be 95% that the real estate lost against gold. So I try and look at the values of, of different asset classes instead of the price. So if you take a single-family home divided by the price of a barrel of oil, you find out how many barrels of oil it's worth. Same thing with a bushel of wheat, a ton of iron, an ounce of gold, a share of the Dow. And you measure all these different assets against each other, and then you start to develop a clear picture of what's overvalued and what's undervalued. And that's the only way you can develop a clear picture, simply because currency, they keep on creating more of, and it gives this illusion that everything is going up. And nothing actually goes up. If you divide stuff against stuff, the true value, how much you can get if you sell your house or your car or a share of the Dow or an ounce of gold, is relatively the same over a century. It just bounces up and down in this range I call a valuation channel. It's part of what I call wealth cycles. I've got a website called wealthcycles.com.
Oh, that's absolutely worth checking out. So with that, I see I've kept you past the promised time, but I do want to direct people to goldsilver.com, where you can find all of the Hidden Secrets of Money episodes are sitting right there, and episode 4 sitting right in the middle of that. Do you have more episodes coming out?
Yes, we have some episodes coming out. Like I said, it was shot in 18 countries. The first episode opens up in Egypt. Second episode is about ancient Athens, so we're on the Acropolis. And then the fifth episode here is going to be about Rome, and because there are lots of lessons and parallels that we can draw between our modern economy today and ancient Rome. And the lessons to be learned are showing us that we, once again, are just blindly going down the same stupid path that societies have been down dozens of times, and it always has the same consequences, and the consequences are negative. But the person that gets prepared can actually benefit from these things, and that's what you specialize in with Peak Prosperity and Resilient Life.
Absolutely. A little preparation can go a long way. And the most important thing is just having the context. It's just knowing where you are in the story so that you're properly oriented. Most people don't have the proper orientation. They don't know where the shocks are coming from or why, and it just doesn't make sense. I see this all the time. I get in these mini debates that, you know, people say, oh, you know, there's more oil coming out of the ground than ever. And then I say, listen, there's some context there. It's really important to understand the expense of that oil and the fact that, you know, there's just simple things, simple clues that people should be able to look at, like the fact that you can look at anyone, I won't name names right now, but you could pick any of the top four shale operators, and you might ask yourself the question, why is it that when you go to their cash flow statement for the past 4 year years running, all of them have negative free cash flow? Their capital expenditures are more than eating all of their operating income. And when you look at that and you say, well, they've been doing this 4 years, the wells deplete in only 3 years. So somewhere in this band, if they aren't making money at it right now, we have to ask the question, when? You know, and the answer to that is I don't think they're really spitting out cash at these prices, which means that even as expensive as oil is, they're not quite getting there. This is just context that people need, and most people aren't willing to dig there, I guess. So my audience certainly is, your audience certainly is, and that's what I love about being in this business, is getting to be around curious people, because it's life. Why aren't you curious? You know, come on. This is an incredible.
Yes, what amazes me is so many people are, recently, the hotel and the restaurant, I was just at a conference, and the hotel was closed for lunch, so we had to eat in the sports bar. And there's so many people whose lives are just completely wrapped up in sports, and the outcome of the sports do not impact their lives, but that's what they care about. And they purposely avoid contact with anything that actually does have an effect on their life. They don't want to know about this stuff. And I think that's the way that actually that a lot of the public is. And, you know, anybody listening to this podcast, congratulations, you're one of the people that is paying attention and learning how you can get ahead of this game and change your life.
Well said. It's sort of another area where we see an opportunity. It's easy to bemoan the idea that there are a lot of people who are checked out, not paying attention, but obviously that just makes more of an opportunity for those who are. And yeah. Someday this will all be completely self-evident and totally obvious and all of that, but we're still sort of on the front side of this bubble is the way I feel it. And when it bursts, we'll be on the other side. Everything's different on upside versus the downside of a bubble. So, but when it comes, right. Boy, it's fast, and it's most people get paralyzed because they don't have a plan. They don't understand what's happening. There's just shocks coming. They don't know what to do. And so,
right. I've often said that 2008 was just a speed bump on the way to the main event. And we are getting pretty close now to that main event, I think.
Well, with that, I'm going to let you go here. Thank you so much for your time, and we'll have links so that people can find your just amazing, amazing videos and all of that. And we'll, of course, always be looking out for the next ones when they come out.
Okay. Thanks, Chris. And I look forward to the rest of the episodes of the Accelerated Crash Course.
All right. Well, thanks so much. And let me know where I can, how much I should be putting into my monthly gold and silver.
Okay. I'll talk with you later then. Thanks.
All right.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.